This is Hazel Kahn welcoming you to Tidings and to my guest, Tom Rowinski, botanist with the USDA Forest Service in Durham, New Hampshire. His specific expertise is to inventory and monitor the impact of the deer population on native vegetation. His credentials include wildlife degrees from the University of Massachusetts and Cornell. He has previously been a scientist and vegetation ecologist for the Nature Conservancy, the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation, and the Massachusetts Audubon Society. I first encountered Tom last October at a community meeting organized by our local town hall. I was captivated by the language he used to address the serious problems we are facing here because of an overabundance of deer. As the problem deepens, those of us who live in the northeastern region of the United States have begun to better understand the dimensions of this problem, and Tom has played a significant role in this education. But he has much more to say, as I learned from his including me in a lively, extensive, and very active email forum. Tom, you've introduced me to a world that I otherwise would know only superficially, and the more I learn, the more I realize how significant and far-reaching all of this is. So I'm really looking forward to what you're going to tell us today, to tell our listeners today. But just to set the stage, how would you characterize the people on that email list? It's basically your community that you belong to. What is it that you and they have in common?
Well, first of all, thank you, Hazel, for having me. This is indeed a treat. And for me, this is a labor of love. Any of us in the conservation business, you know, have great empathy for wildlife, these habitats, and the people who, as you know, in this country, we have a proud tradition that wildlife belongs to all of us. It's held in public trust for our use and enjoyment. So in trying to grapple, in this case, with the deer issue, I rely upon a lot of feedback and information from a network of about 100 people who run the gamut from professional wildlife biologists to other botanists to citizens serving on, you know, local committees or elected officials. So, you know, we feed on each other, we exchange information, and that pretty much characterizes the group.
Basically, you are united by a commitment to conservation, or is that not
yes.
true?
Yes, it is.
Then how did you get here? I mean, let's just a little bit more about your background, your more distant background, you know, where you grew up and how you came to be who you are. I know you told me you have a very parochial background. You told me you're very local growing up.
I grew up in central Massachusetts. I had an older brother who studied forestry. So I studied wildlife, which was similar. And our father was, you know, quite the outdoorsman. So we were exposed to nature at a very young age. How a botanist ended up working with white-tailed deer is somewhat convoluted, but in my previous jobs, I've seen most of Eastern North America and have been able to work in various landscapes. And you know, everywhere I went, I was seeing the problems of too many deer. With my current job, one of my responsibilities is to try to mitigate the threat of invasive plants. I'm a botanist in the Forest Health Protection Program, but what became evident, several of these invasive plants weren't the culprit. They were the symptoms of this larger problem of too many deer in the landscape. And how that mechanism worked is that the deer would be consuming most of the native plants that would otherwise compete with the invasives and keep them in check a little bit. But some of these invasives are very unpalatable to the deer. So they proliferate at the expense of the native plants. So I saw the deer overabundance issue as a way to affect landscape-level improvement in forest health. So that's kind of my recent professional background with this subject.
Well, that leads me actually right into the other question I had. You talk about deer impact. That's really what this is all about. And I think people don't really understand. I think most people who've had exposure to the problem of the overabundance of deer tend to think of ticks or car crashes or eating their hostas or something. But this idea of the forest itself, and you use words like forest disintegration rather than regeneration, and you say that the entire ecosystem has been radically altered by these deer. And there are incredibly dramatic photographs on some of the work you've done. I mean, the forests are pathetic. You know, they're completely thinned out. And so the first time I ever heard the word understory was when you talked to us in Southold. So could you just, you know, what you call the greatest conservation crisis in history, just please describe for people who haven't seen it.
Well, those of us who try to manage natural lands, we're always looking for balance. You know, we all want deer in the forest. But the one thing about, you know, this animal is that it's a very prolific prey species. If you think of it, for millions of years, it has had toothy predators attacking it and wiping it out. And for the past 11,000 years, there have been Native Americans. It was their main source of sustenance for thousands of years. So here's this prey species that's very smart, very fecund, very elusive, that has the potential to build up astronomical numbers if predation stops. And that's what we're seeing in much of the Northeast. You know, we have the blessing that so many of our lands have grown back to forest, and with that, all kinds of wildlife, not only deer, but turkeys and beavers, bobcats are more common now. But again, you know, since people have moved into the sprawl, traditional hunting by people is sort of waning. And we as a culture, you know, very early on, we tried to tame the wilderness, right? We got rid of the unsavory characters like wolves and cougars. So what we're seeing is just a basic, largely uncontrolled population boom of the white-tailed deer. And it may not be obvious. If someone walking into a forest, we all see the trees, and they will live for another 100 years or more, unless a hurricane knocks them down. And it isn't apparent to a lot of people. You mentioned the word understory. Well, that's where the young trees should be, and that's where the flowers should be, and the nectar sources for butterflies, and the whole web of life is kind of begins at the forest floor. So it's a very simple logic to say that if any species can't reproduce, in this case a tree, then that species is doomed on that site. So what we're seeing, you know, across millions of acres is that, you know, these forests are living on borrowed time. You know, every tree that falls down in some of these highly impacted areas is not being replaced. So the term forest disintegration, you know, we are seeing that in certain areas. You know, if you were to take a walk in one of your favorite forests, you know, look for the canopy gaps. Look where a tree fell down in a windstorm and see if, even with that extra light, are there any young trees coming in? And in many cases, the answer is no. So this is a real urgent imperative for those of us within the U.S. Forest Service, because a healthy, sustainable forest provides so many values to us: economic, aesthetic, ecosystem function. Forests purify our waters. So there's a great incentive to keep our forests healthy and sustainable. And again, try to find that balance with the white-tailed deer population.
Well, one of the ways, of course, that the balance could be adjusted is through hunting. And I must confess that before, you know, I encountered you, I have had a very negative view of hunters. I thought they were these sort of testosterone, gun-toting individuals who were just rampaging through the forest, killing creatures, killing deer. You've completely turned around my thinking on hunters. In fact, you are a hunter.
If you look at the entire U.S., it's, you know, 10 million or more deer hunters. You know, there's all kinds of different people who hunt for different reasons. The white-tailed deer is the number one species that is hunted in this country. So these hunters are doing it for sport and for nutritious food for their families, etc. But one thing I get a front row seat witnessing is this change in attitude. I mean, you mentioned the knee-jerk reaction against hunting. in these communities I work with that start to realize that they're having problems with too many deer, the hunters are being welcomed back. And not only that, there's dialogue at town meetings and situations like that where, you know, hunters are no longer feared. They're recognized as, you know, the local firefighter, mostly people in town. So it's a very encouraging development that hunters are being welcomed back, you know, into certain like town-owned properties in Massachusetts, which have been closed to hunting for decades. You know, only now to realize that in trying to gentrify nature, you know, originally saying no hunting allowed. So it had this unintended consequence, not only with regard to wildlife and nature in general, but people all of a sudden would walk in these forests and get deer ticks on them and perhaps suffer collisions with deer on the road. So in a way, people became less safe. And so it's sort of this rewilding of these formerly gentrified natural lands by reintroducing the human hunter, at least. And at the same time, you know, there still are natural predators of deer. So, you know, there is some balance that nature is, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, right? Some of these predators are increasing. In my yard in central Massachusetts, I've seen bear, bobcat, and coyote.
Also, you've told me that you see hunting as an ancient and universal tradition.
Yep. You know, in much of rural America, not only young boys, but young girls do as well. And, you know, hunting isn't something you can just pick up a book and read how to hunt. You know, there has to be this mentoring period. So for years, with my son, and my wife also hunted, he went through this progression. He took the formal courses that a new hunter has to take on hunter safety and hunter ethics. Hunters as a group, we're getting older and slower, and there aren't as many young hunters coming into the sport. And that's one of the problems if you're trying to rely solely on hunters to keep deer herd under control. You know, there just are fewer and fewer hunters, by and large, out there. But, you know, with my son, you know, when he shot his first deer, I thought it was a very proud moment for me. It was like a rite of passage that what it tells the group of grown men there is that, you know, here's a young boy who can use his firearm safely and effectively. You know, in this case, he provided meat for his family as a 14-year-old. And I don't think there are many 14-year-olds who, you know, can boast of that and have that degree of responsibility to use the weapon safely and ethically.
And to be the own source of your food rather than outsourcing it to other people like factory farms or other people around the world.
Yeah, and you know what I think the Native Americans understand and what many hunters understand is it can only be described as a spiritual connection. You know, knowing that you take a life, knowing that you're being a natural predator, there's a real spirituality to that. And, you know, I think, you know, my family appreciates or has a deeper connection to where our food comes from than those who wouldn't think twice about, you know, eating a McDonald's hamburger. You know, in my mind, if you look at where our food comes from and how livestock are grown, we are still very much that wolf. We prey on all kinds of animals for much of our protein. It's just that a lot of it is out of sight, out of mind.
Tom Rewinski, biologist with the U.S. Wildlife Forest Service in Durham, New Hampshire, is talking about his work as a conservationist and the beliefs and values that guide this work. This is Tidings on WPKN Radio. Earlier this year, you were awarded the Integrity in Conservation Award from the New England Society of American Foresters. And they gave this to you because they recognized you as crusading to spread the warnings while there is still time. They also said it's a lonely thing to be, spreading an unwelcome word, but that you were making a big difference, doing what is what they called at times a thankless yeoman's job, and that your message has not always been well received. So is that true, that conservation can be lonely and frightful?
I think, you know, the history of, you know, any conservation movement has an element of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I come up against a lot is organizational silence, or what the author Margaret Heffernan calls willful blindness. So when there's information out there that you know, but somehow you manage not to know, or you ignore, because, you know, look, if you're an agency or a private conservation group, it's just going to stir up the pot, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There'll be a lot of people who will scream and squawk, but, you know, through education, we are turning the tide of public opinion. When you lay it out as an either-or situation, if people are reasonable and they can be convinced, and we're seeing lots of positive signs of that.
That's very reassuring. But even so, with or without success or progress, you have your own, I don't know whether we should call it a manifesto or a credo. You have a belief about all of this. And you mentioned something you wrote, I think it's Hub Vogelmann, who wrote about we made a promise to a mountain. And that you said you understand how he felt because you also have made a promise. Could you talk about that?
Well, you know, in some of these forests I visit, especially years ago when there didn't seem to be anyone else willing to take this on for obvious reasons. It's a risky and potentially expensive proposition. But to do nothing would just see these forests disappear. Yeah, so Hub Vogelmann talked about saving a mountain in Vermont, you know, at all costs. The other things that motivate me is, you know, when I was a student, we learned a lot about Aldo Leopold. He was a great conservationist, great philosopher, and he laid out what he described as a land ethic. And a lot of my work is trying to remind people about Leopold's land ethic. And there's one sentence in his book, Sand County Almanac, where he sort of defines what a land ethic is. He said, a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the biotic community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise. So the whole idea of stewardship of the land, and we talked about balance, and that all comes into play. So, you know, I see that as a universal criterion that maybe we all can agree to. You know, people will disagree, maybe, you know, I want to see more deer or I want to see less deer. But if we can agree that we want nature to be healthy, if we make a commitment to being good stewards of the land, so, you know, we have this balance of wildlife that we can enjoy and derive many benefits from. There's a lot of wisdom there. You talked about, you know, the trials and tribulations of this. Well, Aldo Leopold, 71 years ago, proposed to the state of Wisconsin that they initiate their first doe harvest, basically. Up until that point, it was heresy for anyone to shoot a female deer because that's where the baby bucks came from, and much of the effort was trying to build up the deer herd. Well, what changed it was that the deer became so numerous in the wintering area that there was, you know, massive starvation, mortality. And so the state realized something had to be done. So they, 71 years ago, what's been called the crime of 43, the first doe season was held in Wisconsin. And it was called a crime because there was such a backlash that it only lasted a year. And Leopold was, you know, totally shouted down by the people who thought it was not a wise thing to do. So that was his particular battle that he pretty much lost. But we're in the same situation today. These are difficult choices that we have to make.
I think you said also somewhere that the Leopold land ethic statement, if you will, is like the Hippocratic Oath, the ethical calling of all professionals.
Yeah, you first do no harm. You know, in our case, as natural resource professionals, you know, our patient is the landscape. And much of that landscape, due to this one animal, this keystone species, the white-tailed deer, that can so radically alter and degrade the system, so much of our landscape is not healthy. So, you know, where we have a healthy patient, we should first do no harm. And when our patient is sick, you know, we have to do what's necessary to return it to health as a healthy ecosystem.
Can you tell people what they should read of Aldo Leopold's writings?
A Sand County Almanac. You know, that is classic. Every wildlife biology student has to read it. From a historical perspective, he wrote the first textbook on wildlife management called Game Management in 1939. Also, there's an excellent biography by Meine, M-E-I-N-E, I believe is how it's spelled. So the biography of Aldo Leopold is absolutely fascinating. You can see, you know, what went on during his time.
Talk a bit more about empathy, because I'm not sure that I understand. You know, you said somewhere to me, our hope lies in managing empathy. I just don't understand enough about that.
Well, you know, one quality of being human that's kind of unique to us, you know, whether it has purely altruistic benefits or maybe somewhat selfish benefits. I think we all want to have a healthy environment. We all feel for our neighbors when they are inflicted or harmed by something. So, you know, in the realm of natural resource management, you know, we have to try to understand all the social dimensions of this wildlife issue. There are many stakeholders. They have special values that we should feel for them. Personally, I have empathy for the larger forest ecosystems. I have empathy for, let's say, woodlot owners who try to manage their forests for timber products, and they can't grow new trees. You know, I have empathy for hunters. I have empathy for animal welfare folks who see these animals as beautiful and don't want to see them harmed. And I have empathy for the deer themselves, because one of the saddest things that I come across, Hazel, is that at high population densities, the deer become smaller. They become infested with parasites. They become more prone to disease. They have to travel farther to find a scrap of food. So they are more frequently in contact with cars and roads and people's backyards. So the individual deer at the kind of densities that I see on Long Island, they are pathetic and sad animals. Mm. And I really feel for them. I think we all should, in terms of just what the ticks can do to a young fawn. It just is heartbreaking to see some of these pictures. You know, we all have empathy, and it's all directed toward doing good by nature, doing good by, you know, our fellow citizens.
But we also are all selfish.
In any human being, we have an element of selfishness. It's probably to help our survival in this world. We all have to look after our families and place that above most anything else. But we also have a, you know, moral obligation to be good citizens, to not always think of just our own special interests. To be a responsible citizen, I think we have to sometimes put our personal interests on hold because we care about nature or our fellow citizens. Some of these public meetings I've attended, you could see the consensus developing, and it's never unanimous, and people have, you know, different points of view. But I think we're all in it together. We all have a sense of community. And we all have a responsibility, I think, to that larger community, irrespective or in addition to our own very urgent needs.
Could you talk a little bit more about rewilding and the idea of we should rewild ourselves?
Yeah, rewilding is a concept that many people are promoting, and you don't have to look too far to see one of the prime examples of rewilding at Yellowstone National Park, where wolves were reintroduced deliberately by people, recognizing that here was this large ecosystem that was missing its apex predator. Well, once the wolves got established, the effect on the entire ecosystem was just amazing and radical. You know, the elk no longer damaged the forage, beavers moved back in, shrubs grew, birds nested. that's probably the most vivid example of successful rewilding. You know, if you look at where some of the worst problems are now, where the forests are disintegrating, it's in heavily populated eastern U.S., often in suburbia. So we don't have the option of reintroducing, you know, gray wolves and mountain lions. But we forgot about what has been the most successful predator of white-tailed deer, as I mentioned, for the last 11,000 years, and that's Homo sapiens. And, you know, people continue to hunt, especially in rural areas, but it's kind of novel for hunting programs to be adopted in a more suburban environment. But, you know, many of these programs are very successful. These communities end up being richer for it, more inclusive. The hunters are viewed in a favorable light. And even when it reaches a crisis situation where culling has to occur, I mean, all that venison is donated to food banks and food pantries, and people generally feel good about that. It's hard to say, well, let's just rewild Homo sapiens. But some of it's happening on its own. You know, people feel good knowing where their food comes from. The abundance of deer has caused a lot of people to take up, like, archery hunting. You know, I see some potential to rewild Homo sapiens, you know, not just to turn us into, you know, raging predators, but to give us a greater sense of connection to, you know, who we are as people and where our food comes from. And at the same time, you're helping to restore this balance that is missing, you know, its apex predator.
Mm-hmm. So, Tom, what are you working on now? What are your plans for the future in terms of writing or publishing or anything else that you're planning to do?
I am heavily involved, especially in the summer months, with helping different cooperators, state, private, and federal landowners, to try to evaluate the success, or in some cases, the failure of deer management programs. So I have 650 vegetation plots that I visit every year, and I try to detect an improvement in the growth of these plants based on, you know, some deer management program. So that's a lot of what I do in the summer. I also get invited to work with different communities and organizations on the deer issue, so that keeps me busy. Most recently, I was in the town of Westford, Massachusetts, working with their hunting policy committee. So, you know, working at the town level, it's democracy in its purest form, I think. You know, at these town meetings, everyone has a voice. I really don't publish a lot of scientific literature. You know, I write reports and I monitor things, but I'm not a hardcore researcher at these chairs.
Tom, I really am glad that you spent this time with us. I'm grateful for it, and I look forward to sharing what you've told us with our listeners.
So, Hazel, it was my pleasure.
Thank you very much. Tom Lewinsky, biologist with the U.S. Wildlife Forest Service in Durham, New Hampshire, describe his work as a conservationist and the beliefs and values that guide what he does. Tidings from Hazel Khan is heard on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport. Tidings programs are produced by Tony Ernst and archived at hazelkahn.com.